And we have a full agenda for you here from Connecticut Insurance Commissioner's Office representative here. Gerard O'Sullivan is going to talk to us about coverage and when there's legal loopholes. We're not talking about people who are cheating, as well as, you know, the appeals process and oversight of the whole industry. And then we'll talk to a couple people about pivoting and taking on challenges, which is something a lot of people are going to be doing in the weeks to come as we come out of the pandemic. We hope we're coming out of the pandemic. And then after that, we'll check in with Jenny Van Leeuwen-Herring, who always has all the information for us on markets and money and what's going on. Also talk a little bit about GameStop and Robinhood, as well as what's the difference between investing and gambling. And then we'll wrap it up at the end of the show tonight, the last hour, with Michael Casey from CoinDesk and everything you ever wanted to know about cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and all the stuff that's going on there, as well as their own launch of the TV channel. So a lot of things to do today, but we're going to start with Gerard O'Sullivan. And Gerard, first of all, thanks for being here with us today. We appreciate it.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good. I want to make sure your sound was still good. So you're with the Connecticut Insurance Commissioner's Office. Before I ask you the questions that I already have, tell people what exactly you do for that office. Like, what's your responsibilities in that role?
Certainly. I'm the Director of Consumer Affairs for the State of Connecticut Insurance Department. And we are the public-facing area of the department, and we handle complaints against insurance companies. And we're also statutorily required to educate the public on insurance. We're, unfortunately, one of the best-kept secrets in state government. We try to get out and advise people that anytime they have a problem or question about insurance, to contact us. That's what we do on a daily basis. We recover over $4 million a year for Connecticut consumers in underpaid or wrongly denied claims, and we just help them with the whole insurance process, from purchasing insurance to helping them with claims to just answering everyday questions.
So people shouldn't feel like they're bothering you if they contact your office to get more information. That's what you're there for.
Absolutely, and their complaints help us in real time to see what's going on in the industry and to make sure that insurance licensees of the department are treating people fairly and that they're following Connecticut state insurance law.
Okay. So I know that I have a scenario that was brought to my attention, which was part of the reason I asked you to come and be a guest, but I wanted to at least have people know what it is you do in general before I kind of switched over to that aspect of it. And I think it's really important that you said, you know, how much money you recoup for people and that you want them to reach out to your office. Because I would think a lot of people are, you know, if their insurance company doesn't pay what they thought they would, they think, oh, well, I must have just misunderstood. And, you know, well, that sucks. And they pay the rest of the bill and they move on. And you're saying if they really think it's incorrect, they should, what's the first step they should do? Maybe I should ask it that way. Is the first step to contact your office, or is the first step something else typically?
No, absolutely. It's the first step is to contact our office, and it never hurts to contact us. The worst thing that we're going to say is that the insurance company is correct and they did things properly. And, you know, then maybe the individual would understand their coverage a little bit better. Insurance, unfortunately, can be complicated. So,
yeah. You
need somebody who is a specialist in that area to tell you what you need to do and how to do it. So the best way to contact us is, and we try to make it as easy as possible, is via email, and that's to insurance@ct.gov. So that's very, very easy to remember.
I was going to say, that's pretty simple.
Our website is very easy to get to. Yes. Our website's very easy to get to, www.ct.gov/CID, like Connecticut Insurance Department. And there, you know, you can connect to us directly. There's so much information there. If it's not during regular business hours, we have a lot of information that is self-service, where you can look things up and find out a lot of information. And also, people should know it's not just health insurance. We do auto insurance, homeowners insurance, life insurance, annuities, long-term care, accident insurance.
So any kind of insurance or a claim or anything where somebody feels like it doesn't look right, or they feel like they're not getting what their policy stated, that's a time to reach out and at least find out if it's what their, if their suspicions are true or not. Would you say that's, is that what you're
saying? Correct. And, you know, don't worry about contacting us. Yes, absolutely. And don't worry about contacting us for something that's not under our jurisdiction. We can get you in the right hands. That's what we're there for.
Okay. See, and a lot of that I think is good to know, because people may think of it as a health insurance issue. And so again, good to know that it's any kind of insurance is what we're talking about. You know, the situation that came to my attention, you know, and we're probably going to end up going to traffic and weather before we finish talking about it, but it, it was related to annual mammograms, which in Connecticut, my understanding is there's a mandate that, so that pretty much anyone who's age eligible should get one mammogram screening a year where they're not paying out of pocket. It's going to be 100% covered before their deductible. I mean, is that a correct understanding? Let me just make sure I have that right first.
It is for the most part, but there are some, you know, situations. If you have a high deductible health plan that is connected to a medical savings account, the IRS rules sometimes supersede the state rules. If the state says that it's before deductible, that may be trumped by what the IRS says and the IRS rules for a high deductible health plan.
Interesting.
But again, any of these situations, people should come to us and we'll find out for them exactly what the issues are and give them the answer.
All right. Well, let me give you the synopsis and then, you know, we'll talk about this because the situation, I'm sure, is not a one-off. I mean, this is probably something that happens over and over because mammograms are pretty common. And unfortunately, breast cancer is pretty common. So the situation that came to my attention was, you know, that a woman who had been treated for breast cancer, finished treatments, you know, went to have an annual screening. And somewhere between requesting that from the physician's office and arriving at the radiologist office, you know, the two medical offices spoke to each other, and that preventative screening definition got changed to follow-up. And so she has the mammogram, she submits the claim to insurance thinking it's going to be 100% covered, and instead it gets applied to her deductible, and she ends up with a bill that's about $400 out of pocket. She contacts both medical offices. Neither one will change the coding to screening. They both insist it has to stay as follow-up. And so, and of course, the billing department, they just, you know, so everyone's following the direction of someone else, you know, as far as they continue to bill for the $400 that they want for the coverage there to pay for the screening, when she thought it was going to be covered 100% before the deductible. So that's the scenario that came to me. And I'm like, so that means that someone who has had breast cancer and needs the screening, maybe more than other people, no longer gets a free screening. I'm like, that doesn't seem like the spirit of the law and the mandate, but maybe there's some extenuating circumstances. And I was like, if it's happened to one person, I'm sure it's happened to others. We have about, you know, a minute here before we have to go to traffic. Do you want to make a quick comment and then we'll do traffic and weather? I'll let you elaborate.
Sure. Absolutely. And I think the first thing to do is, you know, just to let people know that, you know, insurance companies, handle claims electronically. So they take what is coded by the providers.
Sure.
And then they compare that to, you know, what's allowed under the plan. So they're going off what they receive from the provider and are unable to change what those things are. But again, you know, if you have an insurance plan, you're going to have a network. If it's an in-network doctor, then the insurance company can reach out.
Okay.
And verify that the coding is correct process with the insurance company.
Okay. You froze up there for a minute. You said, so if it's in-network, the insurance company can reach out and... Just say it again, because we missed it. You froze
their,
up a little. Yeah.
Yes. Through their provider relations area, reach out to make sure that the coding was done as they intended. Again, it's always up to the doctor how these things are going to be coded, but those are conversations that we can at least verify. And we can also look at the explanation of benefits, and that's something maybe we can talk about when we return from traffic.
Okay.
And how people can understand their claims better.
All right. I love it that you're keeping the clock with me here. So, all right. It is 16 after. So let's take a quick break here for traffic and weather on WICC 600. We'll come back and talk more with Gerard O'Sullivan. Welcome back to WICC 600 and Connecticut Today. Just a reminder, this show, you can call in if you have questions, 203-333-9422. We're talking right now to Gerard O'Sullivan, who is with the Connecticut Insurance Commissioner's Office. And we've been talking about, you know, this one situation that came to my attention about the mammogram and follow-up versus preventative screening, and that the patient ended up having to, you know, pay for what she thought was going to be covered before the deductible based on the plan, which said that it would be, but because it was coded as a follow-up instead of a preventative screening, then the ball got rolling with the wrong codes. And so, of course, the insurance company applied it to the large deductible and sent the bill to her to be paid. So I know you talked a little bit, but, you know, what, you know, in this case, obviously you can't, you know, answer the specifics without specifics, but, you know, if you were talking to this woman, what would your advice to her be at this point? You know, she's paid the bill, but she still doesn't think she should have been billed at all.
Correct. And the advice, as always, would be to submit the information to us and we can verify that it was done properly. Again, it's up to the doctor or the provider to do the coding as they see fit. The insurance company can't supersede that. But they can reach out to the provider and verify that that was done properly. It sounds like, you know, she was very careful to read the bill and the explanation of benefits that she received from the insurance company, which, you know, unfortunately, most people don't do. But that will give us clues as to how this was paid by the policy. We can make sure that the insurance company did everything properly and that, you know, any questions that she may have on, you know, why was it done this way and what would happen the next time when it was an annual screening to see, you know, if based on her plan with the high deductible, it would indeed be no cost for her.
So if the provider refuses to change it to screening and insists that they must code it as follow-up, is she kind of like dead in the water as far as there's nothing else she could do?
Not through the department. Again, it would be something that, you know, the doctor would have information as to why it was coded that way,
right.
Why he felt that that was the proper way to do the coding. You know, there's always ways to question bills, you know, to appeal them,
right.
And to make those things. But that wouldn't be through the department. That would be through a separate procedure.
What do you mean a separate procedure?
Through the, you know, if she's paying directly to the doctor, you know, that could be appealed based on what their appeal rights are under that.
Oh.
If the, you
okay.
Know, if the, yes.
Okay. I mean, because if somebody has, you know, I understand coding, you know, with any procedure that the insurance company, as you said, they're just following the codes. They're not, you know, they're not looking at anything else. So if it gets sent in with a code that causes the patient to pay, there's nothing the insurance company can do about that unless the provider changes the code, which is totally common from my understanding that, you know, in any situation, if somebody determines that, oh, we sent it in with the wrong codes, they can resubmit it with the right codes and correct it, right? That's not a big deal.
Right. Absolutely. And that does happen all the time. That the corrections are made on those things.
Okay. Now, are there certain situations that you would say are common that you hear about over and over where they're like the same, I don't know if I want to call it mistake because, you know, I don't have a better word right now. So, but are there certain situations you see that are kind of common mistakes where things get either filed incorrectly or misunderstandings, you know, like where you see the same scenario over and over that you correct it for them or help them?
Yes, probably the most important thing the department does, we have a process which is called external review. And if the doctor states that, you know, a certain service needs to be done, a drug needs to be taken, and the insurance company comes back and denies it, we administer this program, and it's not up to the insurance company to make that final decision. It's up to this process, and it would be an independent doctor in the same specialty of the doctor who made the recommendation for the treatment or the drug, and it's binding on all parties. And that's the ultimate decision as to how this is going to be paid. So when you hear people say that the insurance company, you know, makes these decisions as to whether or not something is going to be paid, ultimately it's not their decision. In all plans that are under the state's jurisdiction and also federal plans, we have this program that's called external review or external appeal, and the insurance companies are required to advise their members of this process if their claim is denied or underpaid.
And I assume that's the information we always see that's printed on the back of the EOB, the explanation of benefits. There's usually a page in there somewhere that has like your appeal rights and it goes on and on. That's what you're talking about in that
Correct.
Case, right?
Absolutely.
All
yes.
right.
And we're
going to take another quick break here for traffic and weather, and then I'm going to let you finish what you had to say. Right now, traffic and weather, WICC 600. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Ann Carrick in for Paul Pacelli this afternoon, and we're talking to Gerard O'Sullivan about sort of all things insurance. You know, and part of the reason I asked you to be on, Gerard, is because, you know, most people feel like, and I think it's true, that insurance companies have a whole department of people sitting around figuring out, you know, legal loopholes why they don't have to pay that claim. And so if somebody feels they've fallen into one of those loopholes, your office is the one they need to talk to find out if they really should be getting coverage for something that they are not getting coverage for. As we went to the break there for news, you know, we were talking about state mandates and some of those things. And I know you wanted to talk a little bit more about jurisdiction and differentiate between a company that's self-insured versus, say, an exchange plan, which is under the state's guidance. So I'll give you the floor there to explain that more. And for people who don't know what self-insured, you know, as I said to you during the break, I worked for IBM for many years and they were self-insured. Prudential processed all of their paperwork. So you were filling out paperwork and forms that said Prudential on them, but IBM was really self-insuring and paying those claims. And so that would be a case of self-insured versus obviously a state policy.
Correct. You know, it originally was mostly large employers who would self-fund, and what they're doing is they're actually paying the claims out of their own money, but they would hire what's usually an insurance company to handle the claims for them. So people would get a card with that, you know, insurance company's name on it. They would use that network, but unfortunately, they don't follow Connecticut state insurance law. They follow laws under the U.S. Department of Labor, usually ERISA laws, and Connecticut has a lot more mandates than the U.S. Department of Labor requires plans to have. So
even though the person is even though the person's in Connecticut, even if the company's in Connecticut, if it's self-insured, it's still not under Connecticut laws. It's under the Federal Labor Department laws.
Correct. Most likely, yes.
All right. Yeah. And you were saying... that it's a small percentage of those companies that actually are under Connecticut mandates, correct?
Yes. Out of the you know, entire universe of commercial insurance in Connecticut, only about 35% is under Connecticut state insurance law.
Okay. So the rest, now when you say only 35%, those are of the commercial. We're not including like Medicare and
correct.
Things like that in that 35.
Medicaid, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
So that's good to know.
Yeah,
so
but don't hesitate.
Go ahead.
We do have authority over the insurance company who is acting as the third party administrator for those claims. So we can make sure that they're following the plan, but we can't, you know, force them to follow Connecticut law. So people shouldn't hesitate to submit complaints to us even on those plans, and we can get that information for them so that they know these things going forward.
Unfortunately, people don't what?
Unfortunately, people don't, you know, take the time to read their insurance policy until something's wrong. So, you know, we kind of try to walk them through that and let them know going forward what type of plan they have, how it's funded, and what their rights and responsibilities are.
So even if like the state of Connecticut says everybody is entitled to fill in the blank, and that's not part of their plan, they can still contact you. You'll help them decipher what their plan is and make sure that they did get the coverage that their plan requires or promises, even if it's not the Connecticut mandates. That's what you're saying.
Correct. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Excellent. I think that's good to know as well. And since we're on the topic, if somebody is on Medicare or something like that and they have a question, can they still call your office, or is that go, does that go somewhere else?
Again, if they are Medicare, they'd want to call CMS. If they have, we do have jurisdiction over Medicare supplement plans. So if that's what their question is about, they can call us and we can assist them with that. But again, it's never, we're never going to turn down a call. If you have a question, we'll point you in the right direction and we'll get you that information. You know, Medicaid is through the Department of Social Services here in Connecticut, Husky,
right.
You know, we can get you over to them right away.
I think what you're saying is going to be a shock to a lot of people that a Connecticut state government office is saying, please call us with just about any problem and at least let us listen to you and find out if we can help. Because that's not really how people view any government, state government, federal, whatever. Usually people think, oh, you know, like I got to call a government office. I'm going to be like lost in a voicemail hold loop for 3 hours. And you're saying, no, call us with whatever it is. Just call us and we'll at least give you guidance, even if we can't fix it or help you directly.
Exactly. And I think you'd find that with most state agencies. They are there trying to help consumers, and they do want to get them in the right hands and get them what they're entitled to. And like I said from the beginning, people contacting us help us to better regulate the industry. They also help us to advise legislators of what's going on and things that may need to be looked at to make changes to the law. And again, that's not just health insurance. It's homeowners, auto insurance, you know, life insurance, annuities,
okay.
Whatever problems you're running into, contact us.
All right. We're going to take another break for traffic and weather. We can talk more with Gerard O'Sullivan from the commissioner's office. And we will also look into what if there is a loophole and how do we fix that in the wording, maybe for those state mandates. Right here on WICC 600. We'll be right back. Ann Carrick here, and we are talking to Gerard O'Sullivan this afternoon for this hour about insurance claims. And Gerard, I know I kept referring to health insurance, and you keep reminding me it's not just health insurance. Your office handles all sorts of things. And that home and auto combined, you get as many questions, give or take, as you do about health insurance. So there's clearly questions out there regarding those policies that weren't on the top of my mind. I want to shift a little bit so we don't run out of time. You know, if we, in the process of having a claim, if a loophole is sort of unearthed, you know, if I use my mammogram example, you know, if the spirit of that law is like every woman should get at least one screening per year that she doesn't have to pay for, and we find out, ooh, there's this loophole that, you know, if this happened and then something else happened, then they don't have to pay it. I'm just using that one as an example. How would somebody go about, like, or the state, how would you go about correcting that if the idea was one a year covered 100%, but that's not what's happening? Is it just changing the wording, or is it like a huge legal process to get something like that changed?
Yeah, it is a lengthy process, but, you know, there are requirements. And again, people should understand that it all goes back to the contract, and the wording of the contract would need to be changed to make it so that these were paid in a certain way. And that's part of another unit within the department. We have one for property and casualty, one for life and health, and they actually review the policies before they're sold to make sure that they follow state law. So it's, you know, it is something that we can take a look at. We work with legislators to see what's going on and what needs to be tweaked and what needs to be better explained in policies. But I want people to understand the number one complaint we receive at the department on all types of insurance is how much the insurance costs.
Oh.
And the more, you know,
the premiums,
the more coverage that you have, the more expensive it's going to be. Yeah. So people who don't have claims, they don't want things covered. They want the lowest possible premium they can. So it's not always the answer to say we should have more claims covered with less copays, less deductibles, less insurance. That's going to result in higher premiums. So it is something that, you know, has to be in consideration when you're looking at the overall picture. And especially with health insurance, you know, affordability is a huge number one issue. And to keep the prices lower, there has to be either increased premiums or increased deductibles. And that happens on the property and casualty side as well. When you're looking at your homeowner's policy or your auto policy, you're going to get a lower cost if you take on more risk through higher deductibles or less coverage.
But of course, you know, my experience has been like with auto insurance, for example, and even homeowners or renters insurance, you get to choose a little bit more, like how much coverage you want on certain things and what you want covered or don't want covered. And with health insurance, with the changes in the laws, it seems like, you know, you have this laundry list of things that is required to be covered. And so it's pushed the prices way up. I mean, I've bought my own health insurance for a long, long time, you know, and it used to be maybe a third of what it is now for the premium, with half the deductible and then otherwise similar coverage. So I didn't change much about what I was getting, but the prices went through the roof because all of a sudden there were all these other things that, you know, were required to be in there, or the insurance companies and the lawmakers just, you know, got together and decided that the market would bear higher prices or something. I wasn't there for all that process, but as a consumer, that's what I'm saying. You know, I used to pay far less and have a better policy. And now I feel like it's far more money because, as you're saying, all those things are covered. Whereas for a home and auto, I feel like you still get a little bit more choices if you want to take that risk. You know, I'd rather have, I'm not going to cover this extra liability. I'm going to take my chances on that. Just like when people have an older car and they drop certain parts of the insurance because it's not worth it because the car would be totaled. So if somebody hits it, like, forget it. We're just going to junk the car and move on. A lot of those choices seem to have evaporated in the health insurance market. And that's a general, you know, statement that just from observation, I don't have all the statistics on that to back it up. It's just my observation. Do you find that's true or am I off base there?
Well, partially, yes, it is true, but there have been unbelievable changes to the coverage, over the years. And, you know, behavioral health coverage has become much more enhanced. Individual health insurance policies didn't even need to have maternity coverage, which, could you believe that? You know,
right.
Limits on a policy. It used to be, you know, lifetime limits on a policy. Those have been taken away as well.
Some of them are good. I mean, obviously claims, pre-existing conditions some of those kind of things. Sure. Maternity, some people might argue if you're
a huge cost. Yeah.
Some people might say, well, maternity, you know, if you're past a certain age, I shouldn't have to be paying for maternity coverage if there's no chance of me having a child. But,
right.
You know, that's
exactly.
That's a different argument.
Yes. And that's why it's up to the legislature to make these decisions about what is going to be required and what's the best for the common good. Those are tough questions to decide. And it does affect people's, premiums. It does reach into their pockets. But that's the way that, insurance law is done. It's done on a state by state basis so that they can make those choices that's based best for the state.
Okay. All right. We're going to take another quick break here. Traffic and weather. We'll be back to wrap things up with Gerard O'Sullivan. Last chance if you have questions for him to call in. But right now, traffic and weather on WICC 600. Welcome back to Connecticut Today. Ann Carrick in for Paul Pacelli. And my guest this hour is Gerard O'Sullivan with the Connecticut Insurance Commissioner's Office. And, you know, we've been talking about all sorts of different things. You know, I started with health insurance. You mentioned that, of course, home and auto together, you have as many questions about those. And then, of course, life insurance. I know you wanted to talk about the fact that people can look for life insurance policies, like if someone has died, to see if there are any policies related to that person that they might not know about. So why don't you give us some information about that so that they know what you're talking about?
Correct. That's something that we've always gotten questions from folks that, you know, their loved one passed away. They're not sure if they had an insurance policy. What can they do? And, you know, up until, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, we didn't have an answer for them. But the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which is every state has their own insurance department, and it's a collection of them. It's a process through them where you can go on our website at the department. And again, that's www.ct.gov/CID and look under lost life insurance. And you can put the information in there for a loved one who has died, and they'll search every insurance company in the United States and internationally and try to find if there was a policy in their name. In the short time that we've had this program, we've found over $13 million in life insurance benefits for Connecticut consumers. So it's definitely something that people should be aware of and take advantage of.
And what kind of information would somebody need if they want to do that? You know, like they have someone who's died and they want to search. I mean, what information do they need about that person to do the search?
Yeah, their name, date of birth, social security number, and all of this information is, you know, done safely encrypted to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and they'll do that search and contact you if anything was found.
Okay. So, well, because I was wondering, you know, even if somebody has that information, they do the search, it doesn't mean they can go in and steal somebody's policy. Not a chance, right?
Correct. It's still the insurance company will look at the policy when they find that, and it'll be based on what the beneficiary of the policy was. That's where the money will go. It'll be based on how the beneficiary was set up, or, you know, it would go through probate process.
Okay. Is that something that most states have?
Yes, they all do that now, and, you know, it's to make sure that people can find these policies and to make sure that insurance companies are delivering on their promises when they, you know, had these policies years ago.
Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit, too, about oversight, because my understanding is that a big part of what your office does is sort of general, all the time, kind of oversight and monitoring to make sure that things are being processed the way they should be, correct?
Yes, absolutely. We work very closely with another unit, which is the Market Conduct Unit, and they go out, even without complaints, and they look at how the insurance companies are conducting business, make sure that they're following the laws, go through their claims, even if there's no complaints on them. But they work very closely with us if we're seeing something real time, rather than waiting for their regularly scheduled review of these companies. They'll jump right on it, do a targeted exam, and get those recoveries that consumers are due. And when we do our complaints, you know, for the most part, insurance companies, agents, and claims people are very upstanding citizens, but mistakes happen. And we don't just deal with the one case. If they come back and they say, oh, we did this incorrectly, we make them go back and see, all right, well, how many other people did this happen to, and to correct their systems.
Well, that's what I was just going to say is two things. Is one, for the most part, they're doing what they're supposed to. You're not finding tons of situations where they're trying to play a game and prevent paying claims. Is that true? Like, for the most part, they're just processing the claims as they're supposed to. But as you said, mistakes happen. Is that the more common scenario?
Absolutely. Or, you know, there's just differences of opinion between liability or value. And, you know, that's kind of why there's all these things that are set up in insurance law to keep these things out of the court system, which would take a long time to have those completed. So we do have an auto arbitration program through the department, which would make determinations as to values of vehicles or how much it costs to repair a vehicle. And that's binding on the parties. And homeowners insurance, if there's a difference as to what the scope of damage is, that can be done through an appraisal clause, which has an umpire, and each side, you know, chooses a person to make that argument, and then the umpire has the final decision. So we do a lot of work with trying to get mediation or get people to agreement on the claims values.
Instead of going to court.
Correct.
Yeah, because that's always a better deal if you can get it done that way. And you said, I think, early in the hour that the ruling from your office that the insurance company is bound to whatever decision you make, correct? Like once you all have looked into a situation, you say this is what needs to happen, they need to act on that.
Correct. If they're not following the law, if they're not following the contract, if we do find that. But, you know, a lot of times it's differences of opinion, and we can't settle everything. Sometimes things do have to be adjudicated by a judge or a jury or an arbitrator. So, you know, but submitting that information to us, you've done all you can. And, you know, we'll advise you what your options are.
Okay. And the other thing you said, I just wanted to repeat for in case somebody missed it, was that if there is a mistake found, like in your regular reviews of things, you know, that people who didn't get paid what they should have received, the insurance companies would have to automatically go back and just pay them what they're due, correct?
Correct. Absolutely. So, and we follow up on that to make sure that those things are done properly and to make sure that they're doing as they're instructed to do by the department.
Well, I just wanted to clarify that because, you know, so often you get one of these legal looking mailings that says, you know, like there's some class action suit happening. In order to participate, you got to fill out these forms and do all this stuff. And, you know, the net benefit to you is going to be like $10 or something. That's not what we're talking about here.
Correct. Yeah. No. You know, that this is individual.
Because those, you always wonder if they're a scam too, you know?
Exactly. Oh, absolutely. But again, I think the thing that people need to remember is, you know, the insurance companies aren't always right. So don't just take their determination as, well, you know, they're the professionals. That's what I'm entitled to.
Right.
It doesn't hurt to check through the department. And we can look at it. And again, the worst we can tell you is that the company was correct, and this is why. But
right.
Oftentimes, you know, we're able to mediate additional funds for you, or we do find that the insurance company did not act properly.
All right. We're going to take another break here, traffic and weather, before we go to the news. And we'll come back and give you the contact information again if you need to reach out to the commissioner's office right here on WICC 600. All right. Welcome back to Connecticut Today. Ann Carrick in for Paul Pacelli and my guest this hour, Gerard O'Sullivan with the Connecticut Insurance Commissioner's Office. So, Gerard, before we run out of time, I just want to review some of the contact information that we talked about. So if somebody has a question or they think they didn't get paid enough from their insurance company, and again, whether it's health, auto, property, car, what do you mention other ones? Annuities. Yeah, you listed a whole bunch of them. Any kind of insurance, life insurance, all those things. They should reach out to your office, if nothing else, to get clarification and direction, even if you can't resolve it. So they have a lot of choices. They can go to ct.gov/CID. They can email insurance@ct.gov, or they can call you at 1-800-203-3447, correct?
Correct. Absolutely.
And what should they know if they're reaching out to you? I mean, obviously, if they have their information organized, it's going to make your life a lot easier. So what do you recommend they do before they reach out for help?
Yeah. Again, we try to be very easy to work with. So, you know, if you just want to call us up and ask what you should do, that's fine as well. Or just shoot a quick email. And, you know, if we need more information to proceed, we'll contact you.
Okay. All right. And so it's time for us to head.
Awesome.
Okay. Sorry about that. You froze for a minute. Welcome back. Ann Carrick in this afternoon for Paul Pacelli here on Connecticut Today. And as promised, my guest this hour is Michael Casey with CoinDesk. And Michael, first of all, thank you for being here. You've had an incredibly busy week. So carving out time for me, I really appreciate it.
I appreciate that, Ann. Thanks for having me on.
I'm so glad you're here because this was something that, you know, I as a news person, I've heard in the news, you know, there's been several stories kind of unrelated to each other, some of them just interesting, fun stories, and some making a big impact, but all about cryptocurrencies. And so I reached out to you having no idea, of course, that you and CoinDesk had your own news going on with the big launch of your TV channel, which we'll absolutely tell people about. But then, of course, you know, Bitcoin surpassing 47,000. And, you know, as we were chatting before we went on the air here, you know, how many larger companies and organizations are now getting into the game, so to speak. Whereas, you know, historically, if somebody said cryptocurrency, I'm not sure anybody would know what it is unless you said Bitcoin, which is one of them specifically. And I know for me, when people said Bitcoin, the first thing I always thought of was ransomware, where somebody has to pay off, you know, their ransom in Bitcoin to have their computer unlocked. I mean, that was kind of, that was the realm into which cryptocurrencies fell. And just in the last several weeks, that's changed dramatically. Even for me, I was in Vermont for a few days. I went into a pizza place and there's a sign next to the cash register that says, "We take Bitcoin." I was like, wow, we've come like right down to everything from buying a pizza to a Tesla to large companies are using it as a trading investment tool. So perfect timing. Thanks so much for that. You know, I'm sure most people have heard the fun stories, the football player that wants to be paid in Bitcoin and the person whose account is locked and he has billions of dollars. He can't get to it and he can't remember his password. And, you know, like I said, the ransomware issue. But as you were saying, that's not really the big news when it comes to cryptocurrencies at all. The big news is the big players, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, what's I think starting to gel, at least at in this phase of this technology's development. I mean, let me step back one moment as well and just say all those stories you keep on hearing, they are part of the inherent Wild West nature of a radical new technology, a radical new idea landing into the world, right? You think about the dot-com boom during the internet, you think of all about it, all, any Wild West moment, the robber barons during the industrial age and everything else with railroads. But this is so disruptive that it's even bigger. They're trying to take on the world with money, which is and essentially a banking system that has been around since the Medici in the late 14th century, right? So this concept of money being something that is not actually managed by a centralized institution such as a central bank, government, or a commercial bank that sits in the middle and acts as the intermediary for the creation and transfer of our money, but instead is a protocol, a system that is actually run by a collective, you know, by anybody, essentially. It's a network that nobody can control. It's a radical idea. And to bring people on board into that and to accept the underlying asset of that, which is what Bitcoin is, which inherently is going to be very volatile in its early years and maybe for decades, is challenging, but it's also kind of wild and crazy. So you get these, it just inherently brings all this action into it. But what, having established that, what is really significant, I've been covering this thing for 7 years now, right at this moment, is one of the core theses that big believers in this space have been saying for some time is now being absorbed by Tesla, for example, the other day saying they bought $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin, by Guggenheim Partners, one of the biggest hedge funds out there, saying that they think Bitcoin could go to $400,000. We've had Citibank, we've had BlackRock, we've had huge institutions say that they really actually now think that Bitcoin can play a role as what's called digital gold. So, and I think of this as a phase in Bitcoin's development that could go on for decades, that at first it needs to establish itself as a digital form of valuable scarcity. Now that might seem really way out idea to the average person.
Come on, cryptocurrency in general is a way out idea for most people.
But
so
gold is a good example. What is gold? Why do we care about gold? We tend to think of it as jewelry and, you know, rings. It is, there are some industrial uses for it, but the vast amount of value that gold has is because gold is valuable, right?
Well, people view
it, gold valuable?
People view it as valuable.
Exactly.
Just like they view diamonds as valuable.
Right. In fact, all value is a construct of our collective beliefs. That's a truism. But the thing about gold is that value is literally for the purposes of having some alternative form of value to everything else, right? I think diamonds are valuable, yes, because I collect them and so forth, but we tend to associate them with jewelry almost entirely, right? But
drill bits? Come on.
There are drill bits, and gold is used in certain amounts of fiber wire and everything else, right? But yeah, ultimately, gold is the one thing that people own because they want it to be an alternative store of value to fiat money,
right?
Right, to dollars, to whatever else, and that's its historical role. It's also historically played a role as currency. So it is this, it is a depoliticized form of money. It's not controlled by a sovereign. And the reason why it's considered that is because it has a bunch of properties. It is scarce. There is only X amount of gold right. in the world, and it's being mined at a very slow rate. And it's relatively predictable. It is fungible, meaning that if you give me one ingot of gold that's, you know, of a certain amount of weight, and then give me another one the same weight, I don't care which one I have, it's going to be worth the same amount. It's divisible. You can smelt it down and you can, you know, make smaller coins or bigger sure. blocks, whatever you want out of it. It's transferable. I can give it to you. I can carry it, right? Those are the qualities that make it, you know, it's durable. It won't die. Like, it just won't go away, right? These are five key qualities of what they call hard money. But that's it. That it has those qualities. That's why you want it. So the brilliance of Satoshi Nakamoto was to say, well, why don't we just, if all it is this construct of something that could have value that exists in, it has those qualities and therefore we can assign value to it. Why don't we create that quality in a digital realm? Because the entire global economy has shifted from being an analog economy to largely being digital. We need a system of value that can function in the same way that cash and gold can, that is just, it doesn't depend upon an intermediary in the middle, and it can be digital. So what we've done is it's scarce. It's only going to be 21 million Bitcoin. It's divisible. People always worry that, how am I going to spend $48,000 on a Bitcoin when in fact you could go 1/8 of a Bitcoin? You can get, it can be taken out of very small amounts, right? It's durable because it is almost impossible to take over the network and destroy it. It's being tested like never before, and it just keeps going, and yeah. no one is in control.
So you know,
You said
something earlier, and you kind of zipped right over it. I'm not sure people heard it, which is that, you know, Bitcoin, since we're talking about that one specifically right now, is just under $48,000 mm-hmm. for one coin, so to speak, yeah. one Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And it could go to 400. I mean, that's almost a 10 times, you know, right. I mean, that's hard for, I think, somebody to imagine that, you know, that the $48,000 today is going to be $400,000 somewhere in the near future, just yeah. as a trading thing.
But look at where it's come from.
Oh, right? I know.
So I first started writing about it. It was about $400, and it jumped up to $1,000, and then it dropped down to about $200. This is 2014, and it stayed there about $400, $500 through 2015, and it started rising again in 2016. We got up to $20,000 at the end of 2017, and then it fell back all the way down to a low of about $3,000 in the midst of the COVID crisis in March, and now it's come all the way back again.
Yeah.
So it looks very volatile, which is true, sure. but that rise over time, if you've held, has been just an incredible gain.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because, again, if it is going to be digital gold, then, and there's only 21 million of them ever in the future there will be, then there's a limited amount of scarcity, and there is this massive amount of demand that has to come into it.
Right.
It's just supply and demand. And so it sounds outrageous to say $400,000, but it would have sounded outrageous to say $48,000 in 2000.
This is true. It's true. We're going to break for traffic and weather here. When we come back, one of the things I want to ask you is, you've been in this for a long time, and so you entered the whole cryptocurrency world at a time when other people probably were wondering, like, what in the world are you thinking? So we'll do traffic and weather here at WICC 600. We'll come back and talk more with Michael Casey from CoinDesk. Ann Carrick in for Paul Pacelli today. My guest this hour, Michael Casey with CoinDesk. And I want to spend a little time, Michael, talking about how you got into this whole field and the creation of CoinDesk at a time when, I'm not sure if you said cryptocurrency, anybody would have known what you were talking about at all. Half the people probably still don't know what we're talking about. But, you know, the fact that you got into it at such, or maybe it wasn't such an early stage, but it seems like it to me, and that CoinDesk was created when I'm sure other people were wondering, like, what were you smoking kind of thing. So, I mean, talk to me a little bit about that. Like, what did you all know that the rest of us didn't see that you thought, oh, this is something that we need to pay attention to, and I want to work on this, and I want to be in this industry?
Yeah. So one point of clarification, but in fact, the question is perhaps even more relevant, is that in 2013, when I got into this, I wasn't at CoinDesk. In fact, I've only been at CoinDesk for a year, but I've been skirting around CoinDesk for a long time. More importantly, in 2013, I was writing for the Wall Street Journal. I was a senior columnist there covering global economics, and I stumbled across Bitcoin at the time and thought, oh, this is crazy. What are you smoking? How could money be something like mined by a computer? What does that mean?
Right.
And I wrote a pretty ordinary column about it, talked about tulip bubbles and things like that. And then a bunch of very smart people took me out for dinner along with some other journalists and said, we just want to get into your heads why this is such a revolutionary idea. And I'd been living in Argentina for 6 years before that. I'd covered for the Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal the crisis that country had been through. It's the failure of its monetary system.
Right, right.
And I suddenly realized that this system could resolve this core problem of trust that human beings have in money. If the institution is corrupt, there's not somebody in control of it. And then, of course, we just come through the global financial crisis that meant that the U.S. and the rest of the world was now doing a big Argentina. And I was able to sort of like, it really gave me the framework for thinking about it. So I suddenly went, wow, this is revolutionary. And Paul Vigneur and I, my colleague at the Journal at the time, got into it. We launched a little thing called BitBeat. And yes, all the newsroom people thought we were crazy. We were the crazy Bitcoin guys.
Right.
Paul and I just did the 6 year anniversary of our book that we wrote together called The Age of Cryptocurrency and CoinDesk TV. But eventually I was into it, so fascinated by the incredible energy and entrepreneurship and just the sheer disruptive energy that people were bringing to this space, that I thought, look, you know what, I've been a journalist for 18 years, I just have to get into it. So I went to MIT, I worked for something called the Digital Currency Initiative for 4 years, which was fascinating. Got to hang out with all the cool nerds doing robots and things.
Total immersion.
But ultimately, media just was always there for me as the thing I love and the thing I've always been involved with. And CoinDesk, I was already an advisor to them, and I was doing a lot of work with them. And eventually Kevin Wirth, the CEO, said, you know what, Michael, we need you to come in and help. Like, we've got big ambitions, and that's why things like this TV channel are part of that.
Yeah.
We need you to lead that process. And I just thought, look, this is the biggest story in finance that I mean it. There's no bigger story in this. That's out there in finance. So the opportunity to write that story, to be at the forefront of it, was just too enticing, and I'm thrilled. It's very exciting.
You know, it's interesting. My previous guest was talking about investing in markets and the pandemic and finances in general. And so near the end, I asked her, you know, her thoughts on this, because I knew we were going to be talking to you, and she brought up Argentina as the example of, you know, where, like she said, you know, for what she does, it wouldn't be an investment. She said, certainly you can trade in it and make money at it. But she deals a lot more with dividend generating investments. So obviously this is not, you know, but she did bring up Argentina as, you know, a place that where it's very useful. And I know my early memories of hearing about Bitcoin or cryptocurrency was in countries where you had a lot of people who were very poor, who didn't have bank accounts and didn't have checking accounts. And so their whole world was run off of a smartphone, you know, and so maybe they were a cab driver and they got paid in Bitcoin on their phone and paid their bills with Bitcoin through their phone again, you know, and so in that environment, you're like, well, that's really helpful. You know, you can really see the value of it existing. Whereas now we're hearing more about it as a way to make money, you know, as opposed to a way to, you know, very practical, useful reasons to trade use it.
This is the tension, really, in the whole development of this technology. As I said before, it's going through this development phase, and it doesn't quite even know what it wants to be yet, right? It's like
when it grows up.
When it grows up, because, by the way, to say it over and over again, nobody's in charge, right? It's like
that's a little scary. Nobody's in charge.
It is, but nobody's in charge of the internet either, right? And so it is just an extension of the same concept that we have this new infrastructure upon which people build things, and we all know how many scary things have been created on the internet, but how many useful things as well, right?
Sure.
So the mindset about criminality needs to think in those terms. But in any case, the fact is there's this tension because, you know, I think when I first got into it, we thought about Bitcoin as being largely its real value was that it would play this kind of payment role. it was and still is so volatile that for anybody who lives in a place where their currency is relatively stable, it's a hard thing to think about as a payments thing, because your groceries, if you put them in dollar terms, are going to be twice as expensive one week as they were the other.
Right.
Less so. It's a harder thing. It generally keeps rising, and so your groceries actually get cheaper all the time. but as a sort of a constant unit of account, it's kind of funky, right? But then again, there are places where, like Venezuela, where the currency is so volatile, the local one, and you can't access dollars because the government has control of the system.
Yeah.
So here comes this thing that is accessible and the government can't shut it down. And yes, it's a bit volatile, but it's better than the Bolivar. So there you start to see, and we've seen it in Nigeria. And Nigeria is now trying to shut it down, right? Because
exactly. Let me stop here, just because we have to do traffic and weather, and we're going to check news at the bottom of the hour. And then we'll come back and talk about that, because in volatile areas, there's definitely a need for it. All right. Traffic, weather, and news right here on WICC 600. Welcome back. Ann Carrick here. Michael Casey from CoinDesk is my guest this hour. And we went to the break. You were starting to talk about, and I cut you off, about some of the pushback that I guess Bitcoin specifically is getting. For example, Nigeria, where they're trying to prevent it, and how people are now asking for more rules to be put in place. So that it, I was going to say, it would be safer or appears safer, so that more large organizations will participate. Is that kind of where you were headed with your comments? And then I'll let you elaborate.
It's sort of. Nigeria is an extreme case, right? That's okay. Actually trying to ban the currency altogether. That's not at all what institutions want by any stretch of the imagination. Certainly not the institutions that are investing in it.
Yeah.
Nigeria is an interesting case. It is potentially, there's this fear that their own control over their monetary system will be lost because so many people, there's a lot of protests and things, and there's been problems in Nigeria, would start to use this currency, which would compete with their own, right?
Instead of their own currency.
Yeah, that's a much more extreme position. And there's also potential play from China in this, which is producing its own digital currency. That's a whole other story. But when
Do you think there's a real chance that any cryptocurrency would replace a government's currency completely?
Certainly in places where there is, Venezuela, absolutely. What typically happens and has happened in the past is the replacement in places where these currencies collapse has more recently been the dollar, right? But some places that, we end up with wampum or anything. This currency collapses are a real experience in history. When Zimbabwe collapsed, eventually they got the US dollar. The Bolivar has collapsed in Venezuela, and against all of the government's wishes, they had to accept that the dollar would become currency. But they still make it very hard for people to get dollars, and so Bitcoin is quite popular in Venezuela. It is very possible that Bitcoin could come into those places, or at least some system. Bitcoin is still an expensive thing to use for some people, and it's not always easy, but there's new technologies, particularly this thing called Lightning, the Lightning Network, which is going to get nerdy here, but that is going to make it much, much easier, and already is in a lot of those places, for people to move Bitcoin around without having to pay the high cost of using this very, very heavy network that Bitcoin uses. It's got a lightweight solution called Lightning. That is a divergence, though, because if we go back to what the original point we were talking about was, is like, there's this other concept of regulation about, like, and it's really just to do with what rules should be in place at what we call the on and the off ramps into and out of Bitcoin. So if you want to buy Bitcoin, you have to sell dollars to get in, or if you want to sell Bitcoin, you got to buy dollars. There are exchanges who sit in the middle of that, and most of them are what we call centralized exchanges, which means they take custody of your dollars or your Bitcoin, and they trade on your behalf, and then they give it to you when you want to take it out. Those exchanges are regulated. They are treated as if they are money transmitters. That is, they are bound by a lot of rules that exist throughout the financial system. There's this FinCEN agency, there are state-based agencies, and they make you do all these rules to keep identities of people, right? So
right.
Anti-money laundering, know your customer rules. When you go to a bank, you have to tell a bank exactly who you are, what you've got. That is kind of antithetical to the core concept of Bitcoin, which is supposed to be like cash. You can use cash without the person knowing who you are. It's called a bearer instrument. That's what Bitcoin's supposed to be. But if we regulate it, we lose that ability, and therefore it's not as easy for people to get into, which means it will create a barrier to what's called financial inclusion. So the Nigerias, the Bolivias, the Venezuelas, those places have trouble on that basis. The institutions, on the other hand, the Guggenheims, the BlackRocks, the MicroStrategy, the company that's put all of its treasury into Bitcoin,
they would like to see some of that regulation.
Because then other institutions can buy in, because those institutions are bound by very strict compliance rules. So they want to see more of their type come in, because that will just drive up the price, right? So, so there's this tension there. You know, are we destroying the original ethos and goal of Bitcoin, which was to be precisely this thing that would level the playing field and allow everybody to get in and trade with each other without these institutions in the middle? Or are we now creating a model where it's just the big guys again, right? That's where the tension is.
Yeah.
And to be honest, there's a whole bunch of arguments on either side of it.
And you can't have both.
Yeah, no, you can't.
You can't have two different systems playing at the same time.
You can't have it both simultaneously. I think maybe there may be an argument that you say we could transition to something in the future that becomes more accessible, because there are a lot of interesting technological solutions to those constraints. This is the thing about this technology. People find very artful ways to get around regulations legally because of the technology.
Okay. We're going to do traffic and weather here again on WICC 600. When we come back, Michael, I want to talk about we talk a lot about Bitcoin because I think they were, if not the first player, the big player. But, you know, let's talk about some of the others, like how many is too many? Who are the newcomers? You know, are different ones set up better for different things? All of that kind of aspect of it. So we'll check traffic and weather and be right back on WICC 600 to further discuss this.
Is there another break after that? Or
there is. Ann Carrick here. We're back with Michael Casey from CoinDesk. We've been talking about cryptocurrency. So, Michael, I wanted to ask you, because Bitcoin is the big player, the one everybody's heard of probably, if they've heard of any of them. And now there's all these other newcomers. So what's going on with all the other ones? Is there such a thing as too many cryptocurrencies? Are the other ones going to disappear? Are they just startups that are not going to make it, like the .com world had? You know, so talk to us a little bit about the newcomers, the other players, where they're headed, and is there such a thing as too many currencies?
So it depends what you're trying to be. A lot of these tokens are part of a blockchain system for things like smart contracts to develop entirely new different models of managing contracts and relationships in a decentralized way. They're really not even comparable to Bitcoin in terms of what Bitcoin is trying to be. Bitcoin is trying to be a new form of money. It's inherently, for the moment at least, largely focused on just being a store of value. I think it's impossible that there could be anything that would be able to catch up to it right now, at least if it is trying to be this decentralized version of this. Of course, China's about to have a digital currency launched. Other countries, that's a different story. These nation state fiat currencies may well compete with it. But I don't think it's possible precisely because of the network effect. To be valuable is to have a lot of people. That's what the value of money comes from. Just as say if Facebook or anything else, its value lies in its size of its community, right? It's a network effect.
Yeah.
It's literally impossible. On top of the fact that the more people and the more values in the network, the more secure it is. And security is the most important thing when it comes to these systems. But if you're looking at Ethereum, for example, which has a token called Ether, you can trade that and own it. Ether is more like oil. It is a commodity that is used to incentivize people within that network to actually come up and build all these other systems on top of it. It really is kind of too complicated to go into right now, but it is phenomenal.
We only have an hour.
It's a rabbit hole if you want to go down it, and it's fascinating and it's very important, and there's lots of fascinating things being built upon it. So, but then there's all these competitors with Ethereum. There's a Cardano. There is a thing called Algorand, and they're all very, very interesting and very sophisticated. People might say Ethereum is also too big. You can't take over Ethereum. I'm not so sure about that one, but nonetheless, it really depends on what you're looking at and what you're trying to do. But I don't think there could be another competitor to a decentralized digital gold, which is what Bitcoin's trying to be.
Okay, at least not anytime soon.
It would have to, you'd have to sort of, I don't know how you would do it. China could do it, but that's not the
but
point.
But then that's not decentralized,
that's
then
not
it's
it,
China's.
Right? Yeah, I don't know how you would organically create I might just not be imagining this, but just seems, at this stage, it seems to me somewhat impossible.
Does that make Bitcoin the reliable one, so to speak, at this time?
It is. And by the way, it's not because it's better. Like, this is the point. Like, it's not, it is going to get, it inherently is better because there's more people using it. The more people are using it, the more developers, the more.
Right.
So the technology has inherently got so many more people working on it. It's therefore better because it's not a company. You need lots of individuals working on it. So, yeah. So it is kind of better for that reason, but it's also not the reason. The reason is because lots of people have it, right?
Right.
Gold is valuable because people chose it to be valuable. Is there a better version of gold like platinum? Maybe, but gold is the one.
Right.
Similar to Bitcoin.
Okay. Which is probably why they're getting some of the pushback now on carbon footprint because of that huge network. But we won't go in that direction because I want to talk a little bit more about CoinDesk. You know, I mean, you've been really nice to be here and tell us all this great information. But I would like people to know, you know, first of all, I guess if somebody's really interested in cryptocurrencies and they want to know more, they should be going to CoinDesk to watch podcasts and tune into the new TV station that you launched because you are the, at least in my mind at the moment, you know, you are the source for all of this information.
Yes, we are. And we would like to think that we are going to continue to be. Oops. I mean, look, the bottom line is, as I said, this is the most important story in finance for this time being. And once you understand why it is huge. And so we believe that the future will be defined by this technology and even just that, just the concepts that are behind it, a more decentralized architecture for managing money. And it's very important, therefore, that there is a reliable, trusted news service media platform for that.
That's keeping track of it and informing people of what's going on and all of that. Yeah,
exactly. We're kind of, we're calling it a moat strategy. So we're building a TV channel, we have a podcast, as you mentioned, we have a real-time news service, but we'll also have a sort of a more magazine long-form type of stuff. We have research. Most importantly, we also have events. We have the biggest and most important event of the year. I'm going to make a shameless plug. It's called Consensus. It's now all virtual, and so for the tickets are nowhere near as expensive as they used to be when we used to do it in New York. But it is most definitely the biggest. And one of Connecticut's own, Ray Dalio from Bridgewater Associates, we just announced today, is headlining as keynote speaker. We've got you know, all of the top regulators from FinCEN, from OCC, from others speaking at this. It is the most important event of the year. That's another part of our strategy, right? So CoinDesk we see ourselves as this platform, and we recently acquired a company called TradeBlock, which is the leading provider of indexes and data. Which is another piece of this puzzle, right? Because people need just trusted information around not just the stories that are written, but also the pricing and the data. So TradeBlock is being integrated into CoinDesk as well. So yeah, it's an all-encompassing take on the world, the biggest story in finance. It's a global strategy. It takes a lot of work. We're all utterly exhausted, but it's exciting.
Yeah,
It's very exciting.
I mean, maybe I shouldn't ask you this, but is there even a competitor that does similar things? You don't have to say who they are if there is, because
there's a number of crypto news organizations out there, CoinDesk is widely recognized as the leader in this space. We like to think that our real competitors, and I don't want to give them any ideas, but you know, are Bloomberg and Reuters and the Wall Street Journal and others. You know,
the big financial news people, right?
Right. I mean, the way I think about it is this, right? We are writing about the emergence of a new, entirely new paradigm for finance in the same way that the internet was an entirely new paradigm for business and e-commerce. And no one talks about, you know, internet magazines anymore that just focus on the internet. You know, you don't go to internet conferences, right? So at some point, this topic, you know, cryptocurrencies and blockchain, and the underlying decentralized architecture beneath it are going to be so part of the norm that everybody be writing about it. So eventually that's, I think, what we become.
Right. You know, and I worked for an agency that used to hold an event like that for social media, you know, where people get together to talk about like how to be on social media and how to get a message out and how they work. And obviously they haven't held that event in years because it's just part of the culture now. So you're saying we're going in the same direction.
Eventually, I mean, we're still very early days, which gives us an opportunity to take advantage of this moment.
Sure. All right. Traffic and weather again here on WICC 600. And then we'll be back with Michael Casey from CoinDesk to talk more. And Carrick here with Michael Casey from CoinDesk on Connecticut Today. And Michael, you were talking about the event that you have. What did you say? I'm sorry, the name just flew out of my head.
Oh, yeah. It's called Consensus.
Consensus, so thank you.
Go to CoinDesk.com. You'll see a button for events. You click on events, you'll find, and there's probably a more efficient way to get there, but it's the one that I know.
That's right.
You'll see the events button, and you'll click on Consensus. You can register for the event there.
And who goes to that? I mean, you mentioned some of the people, but are they companies or individuals or both?
We're very proud of the fact that this is really the big tent event of the year, right? So it's considered to be something that there's a huge range of people with an interest in this space. Some of them are investors, some of them are developers, some of them are companies that are building, entrepreneurs, some of them are large established Fortune 500 companies, some of them are smaller companies. There are regulators, there are academics, there are all sorts of people who have an interest in some way in this very transformative technology. So it's everybody for that, and it's a rare event in that sense. It's a bit of everybody. Obviously, one day, as we said before, you won't be able to do that because there'll be no such thing as a blockchain conference. It'll be everything. But for right. now, there is a role that we can play for everybody. So we get everybody there.
Okay. So we don't have a lot of time left here. If people have been listening and feel completely confused now, they go to CoinDesk. Where should they start? Like, what are the – you have a lot of resources there on your website.
Yeah, we do. I mean,
what would be a good place for them to start?
I mean, there's a bunch of Bitcoin 101s that you can go to there. I can also tell you I've written two books on this space. One is called The Age of Cryptocurrency. It's generally regarded as a fairly good starting point, not just for getting your head around what the currency is, but more importantly, why it matters. I wrote that with my Wall Street Journal colleague Paul Vigneault. Then we wrote another book called The Truth Machine, which is more about the blockchain and its broad uses beyond crypto. Those are useful. There's lots of other books as well that are out there. I would try some of the Learn 101 type experiences, including our own at CoinDesk, that sort of thing. Start listening to podcasts. I do a weekly podcast called Money Reimagined with Sheila Warren from the World Economic Forum. Those things are useful.
And what are your thoughts on, because I guess there's now basically brokerages that, like, so if somebody wants to invest in cryptocurrencies, they can go basically to a broker and make all their transactions through that, you know. Do you view that as a good way to go about it?
Yeah,
or
I wouldn't want to endorse one or the other.
No, not any one. I just mean in general.
Yeah, there are plenty of exchanges out there now, loads and loads of them. There are wallets and exchanges. You can look up. There are some that are very well established. We're starting to see now mainstream companies use this, and so PayPal is offering it. Some of the regular wallets, like Square's Cash App, and these things. So, you know, you can go to those sorts of places. You can go to a range that are sort of, you know, the classic cryptocurrency wallet exchanges. These are very long established companies right now, well, at least by crypto terms. Some of them have been around for like 6 or 7 years.
Right.
How
does that actually work? Somebody like PayPal or Square, you know, if they're going to accept a cryptocurrency payment.
The PayPal version is actually a little bit weird because you don't actually get to own your Bitcoin. I don't fully know, but it's not. A better example would be a Coinbase, which is the classic, most well-known crypto exchange, probably, at least in the United States. There's others like Kraken. I just want to make sure I mention a few of them because I don't want to endorse them. There's a Bitstamp, there's eToro. There's a lot of these guys. What they do is they'll link to your bank account. And just as you can use that bank account to load money, for example, into Venmo, you can load money into this wallet exchange, and they will do the exchange for you, buy you the Bitcoin. And then this is not the case with the PayPal version, but then you can take it off there. You can transfer it to a Bitcoin address that you control. This is the key point about custody and non-custody. Mm-hmm. So that's the real power of Bitcoin, lies in you being able to control it. I have, you know, people like you have these hard wallets, they're called. This is a whole other rabbit hole, but something that is offline that is nonetheless connectable back into the system that you can then store your own, and you completely control that.
Okay.
As opposed to if it's sitting on an exchange where they've got custody. Anyway, that process allows you to acquire it. Once you've got it, you've gone through all the KYC and AML rules and all the stuff you have to do, you can then move it off and you can do what you want with it.
Right. Because that's why, you know, like when I went into that pizza place and they said, you know, we take Bitcoin, I was like, wow, interesting. And at the same time, I thought, even if I had Bitcoin, like, how would I pay you for a pizza in Bitcoin? I'm confused. Like, how would I go? And especially if it's $47,000 for one, like, that's a very expensive pizza. You know?
It's really not. Yeah. No, but it's not going to work. It'll tell you it's a tiny amount of Bitcoin.
Well, no, but
these things are all built into exchanges now. So it'll immediately tell you what it is in Bitcoin. It'll plug it in, and you can, and there's things like QR codes. You just put the phone up against their QR and boom, it's done. It's actually very good. Understanding how and what the system works, and some of it is clunky, but those sorts of interfaces are very easy now. Paying it'll tell you what it is in dollars, how much is coming out of you.
Right.
You know, it's, yeah. It's,
I feel like I'm having a bad flashback to when I was a student years ago living in France, and the dollar, well, the dollar was very strong. And so we had, at the time, traveler's checks. And so we wouldn't convert them to francs, it wasn't even euros, until like the last minute, because we were holding on to them, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what I said, you know, all the converting back and forth. All right, we're going to do traffic and weather one more time, and then we'll come back. We'll have a few minutes left, and I'll give you the last word, Michael, on anything you want to share with us about cryptocurrency and CoinDesk. But first, traffic and weather on WICC 600. Thanks for being with me today, and Carrick here in for Paul Pacelli. And this last hour, we've been talking to Michael Casey from CoinDesk. And so, Michael, let me give you the last 2 minutes here. And what do we need to know that we didn't talk about with cryptocurrency and CoinDesk? Go for it.
All right. So I would say that the thing to think about most acutely as to why Bitcoin is rising and where things are going is to put this in the context of the uncertainty associated with the global financial system in the wake of the COVID crisis. It, as much as the dollar is still very, everybody wants dollars now. The dollar is still the kingpin of the world. There's an enormous threat to sort of the global financial system because of the amount of debt that the governments of the world have brought up. And there's real concerns as to how they are going to collectively resolve those debts without printing a lot more money to resolve that, which could create a currency war. So there's this concern that the dollar starts to get caught up in that and people are going to look for alternatives. China is producing its own digital currency, which will be a competitor in this space, which will allow people to bypass the dollar. So the whole idea of the dollar as a reserve currency is something that is at least theoretically, if not actually, in people's minds right now about the future of the financial system, which is what Ray Dalio is going to be talking about, consensus. And inside all of that is this idea that we're going to have to need some other store of value for a much more fragmented digital economy that's emerging out of this. And Bitcoin is a very much a part of that conversation. So think hard about the big picture and then start to think about why this stuff matters.
All right. Thank you again, Michael Casey, CoinDesk, Consensus. If you want to know more, CoinDesk.com. All of those are great resources. And otherwise, keep listening to WICC. Paul Pacelli's on tomorrow morning with all of your news and information right here. Thanks for being here. Have a great evening.